You're listening to Eric Rogel Talks with Warriors, Lovers, Kings, and Heroes, where you'll hear real stories of the journey to modern manhood, told by the men who lived them. Raw, real, and 100% unapologetic. And now, here is your host, Eric Rogel.
Hey, this is Eric Rogel, and thanks for joining me on Warriors, Lovers, Kings, and Heroes. This is where each week you're going to hear real stories of the journey to modern manhood told by the men who live them. And I've got another great story for you today. And today's story is not only inspiring for the journey my guest took, a journey from living in poverty on some of the most dangerous streets in the country where he was taken off the path to a life of violence and crime, ending up playing in the NFL for the Baltimore Ravens, because that story in and of itself is inspiring enough. It's one of survival and rescue and redemption, being mentored by strong men of all types who recognized his greatness and guided him on a path to success. But it's also about what he did after his football career ended that shows what it is to be a hero, to be truly heroic. So my guest today is Tyrus McLeod. And his name may not be familiar to you unless you're a diehard Ravens fan, because Tyrus spent his entire career with the Ravens as a backup linebacker to the great Ray Lewis, which means he saw very little playing time. Now, he's going to tell you about his years with Ray and what he learned from him. But before he got to the NFL, McLeod believed he would just follow in his older brother's footsteps and end up in prison, because McLeod grew up in what he describes as one of the worst zip codes in the country. He's one of seven brothers and sisters raised by a single mom. The father of McLeod's three older siblings was murdered. Then his own father went to prison. And when he was 11, his mother's third husband drank himself to death. So McLeod had to survive on the streets however he could. And his size allowed him to bully and shake down his classmates and other kids on the streets for money just so he could eat. It was a life he said was intense, but one he just saw as normal. Fortunately for McLeod, some strong men entered his life. The first was an unlikely mentor. It was his older brother, who was serving time in prison. And you're going to hear how he guided McLeod away from making the same mistakes he had made and living a life of crime. Now, the others were his football coaches, who saw in him a rare talent and took him off the streets and onto the field, giving him an outlet for his rage and a way to a better life. And now, with his NFL career behind him, McLeod has dedicated his life to helping other young men from his old neighborhood get off those same streets and guide them to a better life. So I asked McLeod how living on the streets, fighting for survival every day, could be seen as normal.
Yeah, it felt normal because every day you kind of running for your life. I remember our daily hustle, my sister and I, who was closer to me, she's 5 years older than me, we used the men that would drink a lot in the neighborhood who would hustle for money. So she would sit on their laps, let them like touch her. And so it would be like, while I kind of like take money out of the ashtrays or out of their pockets. And, we didn't realize that, if we got caught or somebody could really take our life or try to hurt us and harm us.
Sure.
Yeah, it was just one of the things, those games that we played with our lives.
Wow. And that was normal for you? Like that was a normal thing. Family was doing it. This was just the way it was.
Yeah, that's just the way it was. We always looked for a way to try to get an extra dollar so we could eat or just clothes or something, and it was always within that circle of that community, a way to hustle.
I wanted to know about McLeod's family, his brothers and sisters, and how they stuck together to survive.
Well, my oldest brother was like 8 years older than I was. He ended up going to prison about when I was about maybe 12 or 13. But he was a drug guy in the streets, Not only did he smoke drugs, but he hustled people for drugs as well. My sisters, like I told you, they were just kind of the toys in the neighborhood, sexual toys in the neighborhood. And then my older brother, nobody really never tried to support each other or encourage each other. It was just a point to where you had to use what you thought was a gift to get ahead. And
so it was like everybody for themselves, is what you're saying?
It was everybody for themselves. And that was the course that I was on that was scary once I kind of hit about that age of 15 age.
Yeah, so that's how you basically came up. It was, you know, I've got to look out for me. No one else is looking out for me. I've got to get everything on my own. Is that?
Yeah, that was it. It was how do I, you know, fill my belly with the next meal or look for the next thrill? It was just getting to the next moment.
So living moment to moment to moment, how am I going to get the next?
Correct.
Yeah. Where's mom during all this? Were you getting anything at home? I mean, even love, support, anything? Or, you know, what was going on there?
Well, the love we were getting was that she was trying her best to make sure the ones that were home consistently had a meal.
Mm-hmm.
She was trying her best to make sure we had a roof over our head, which was the main thing that she did. She always said, you know, my job is to provide you a place to sleep and a roof over your head. And that's the best that she felt she can do. And that's what she did. It wasn't any encouragement as it relates to, hey, you know, this is what we need to do every day. This is how I'm going to tell you to go to school. This is how you should study. This is how you should treat people, talk. It wasn't that. It was more, you know, I'm providing, I'm working, and I'm giving you a place to stay. And so with that, she would hope that we would figure it out.
Yeah, everything else is your responsibility, right? She wanted you to figure it out.
Right.
How did that feel when you were going through that? You know, you said earlier where you grew up seemed kind of normal, but did that seem like a normal family life as well?
No, it didn't seem normal. It was normal for us, but when I go to my friend's house that have parents that actually tried to raise them and be, you know, engaging with them, I felt the difference. I saw the difference with those kids than I saw with me. I was more the angry, want to be bully type, and they were more of the helpful, want to be supportive type kids. And it was just that's how we were being raised.
Yeah. So you were a bully, you were angry when you were younger.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it came from what I saw and what I was going through and what I didn't have, and I was jealous that other kids had. And it wasn't so much material, it was more about relationships.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, when you see a mother walks her son to the bus stop and hugs and kisses on him, or you know, somebody's there to pick him up when the bus arrives at the bus stop, or when you see a kid with a bag lunch, you know, I got upset at any little thing that I see that somebody had support. You know, and so that it frustrated me because I didn't have mom making lunch. I didn't have anybody walking to the bus stop. I didn't have anybody hugging on me, kissing me, and wishing me a good day. So it just made me angry.
So it was the jealousy, really, of seeing others that had that, and it's what you wanted to have yourself. Is that what
exactly?
That was?
Yeah, it was. It was jealousy, right?
So you were acting out, angry, bullying, all of that.
Yeah. Every chance I get, I act out. I mean, I stayed in fights. I stayed in, you know, challenging people. Every little thing, you know.
Yeah.
I feel bad about it today. Sometimes I see people that I will say, hey, you know, you got to have my $2 tomorrow. I better have my $5 by Friday. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it hurts when I see even at this age, people that I, you know, did that with.
Yeah. Do they ever say anything to you when you run into them?
Yeah. They say they try and joke about it, but I know it affected them just as much as it affected me. Because you know, here I am. I mean, I'm almost 45 years old, and I got guilt as a 15-year-old. That's scaring the heck out of somebody.
Right. 30 years later, you're still carrying that.
I'm still carrying it. Right.
McLeod is still carrying that and a number of tragedies and traumas that he endured as a kid. But rather than let them take him down, he uses them as motivation to help others who grew up like he did. So I asked him to tell me about these traumas.
Yeah, I you know, I guess it was all over the place with trauma. One of the things I remember vividly is my uncle dying from AIDS. I was about 14 years old. And I've seen people die in my neighborhood, you know, because you get murdered or something like that, or a fight, but I didn't see anybody die from a sickness. That was to watch him like deteriorate. And so that was one of the things when AIDS plagued our community, that really hurt my grandmother. My brother going to prison was actually a good thing for both of us because he was more like my father, figure. He made sure that he ran me out of the streets when I even tried to fight him. But most importantly, when he was in prison, he was the person that mentored me while he was in prison. And it wasn't a mentor in a way of a spiritual sense. It was more of telling me what's going on while he was in prison.
With
the fights, murders, the rapings, and all that.
Yeah.
And challenging me to do the right thing and not follow his path.
So how old were you when this was going on?
I was about 15 years old. And, he could call me and say, hey, look, man, I'm about to do 100 push-ups. I need you to get down and do 100 push-ups with me. So right there on the phone, we'll do 100, 150 push-ups. Hmm. He'll get up, and I can hear him breathing hard, and he's trying to catch his breath. And he's also telling me, on the Knicks stall over, you know, two guys are going at it right now, fighting, another guy's about to plot on another guy. And so it was literally shaping me to say, hey, my brother says, no picnicking there. It's not a place that you want to be. So he inspired me through those times. Yeah.
Wow. Did he like that with you beforehand? Was he kind of a mentor before he went into prison, or?
No, he was far from that. He was the guy that, you know, I would go out, bully somebody, or if I get in a fight and three guys wanted to jump me, you know, my brother was there to help. Got my back. He would fight for me. My brother was, you know, he made sure that if I got too late, I went home, made sure I took a bath, I had something to eat once in a while. But it was more about survival when he was on the street.
Yeah. And then once he got to prison, so he had a like kind of a, almost an awakening when he got to prison about what he'd done with his life. And it was more, I don't want you to do this.
Yeah, when he got to prison, it was an eye opener for him. And I didn't realize how much he loved me because, you know, we didn't share love. We didn't share those kind of words. We didn't share inspiration. But he really made it a point to talk to me while he was in prison. Yeah. That changed my life.
Sure. And is that what kept you out of prison yourself?
Yeah, it moved me towards sports. It moved me towards something productive. I wasn't an academic kid. In fact, I was labeled, slow learning disability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was just because we didn't have educational resources. It wasn't that I wasn't smart. I just was lazy.
Right.
So I went towards sports because it was something that I felt I was a physical guy that I'd be good at. I never liked football, but I did it because of the fact of I wanted to do something productive. And that's what he was challenging me to do.
And so your brother was challenging you to play football.
Yeah, my brother was challenging me to play football, right. He challenged me to do it, to get out of the streets, to go sign up and play. I went out, I played. Like I said, I didn't like it, but it felt good to hit people.
Mm.
It felt good to be around people that gives you support for being good. And so I used the game in that way.
So you were able to not only get, you know, have a, I'll say, positive outlet for that anger and frustration. Like you said, it was good to hit people. But it was in a positive way. You were doing it in a productive way. And you also had that support, mentoring, coaching, direction that you've been looking for. That was the cause of that frustration.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I got more of it through the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
tell me about that.
Yeah, that the coaches, they knew that that I was a kid after, you know, I didn't have a ride home at practice. I couldn't afford cleats. I couldn't afford the resources to play football. And when they saw where I live and when they take me home, their hearts kind of went out towards me because they saw the potential,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't know how long it would last because of what the lack of resources. And so they began to encourage me, but also support me to make sure I had what I needed to play the game and also be successful in academics, you know, eligible enough to play. Yeah.
Wow. So they really kind of got behind you in all of this.
Yeah, they got behind me. I didn't see the potential that they saw. They saw me going to college. They saw me going to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just a normal kid coming from the neighborhood thinking I didn't know what talent I had. No.
Sure. Did you believe them? And what did you think they were doing when they were doing this for you? I mean, after having no support, no nothing,
mm-hmm.
to go towards these men coming into your lives and giving you all of this support, telling you that they believe in your potential, that you could go pro doing this, what's going on in your head? You're like, how old are you? Are you still like 15, 16 at this time?
Yeah, at this point, like, you know, 16, 17, somewhere like my junior year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was going on in my head was that, you know, basically, you know, in my neighborhood, you know, it's white guys. My mm-hmm. neighborhood, you only, if you, you know, white, my neighborhood, you're buying drugs or you're the police. And so here I am being busted in a suburban neighborhood, Nova High School out of Pompano. And I got these white gentlemen that are supporting me, helping me. My thought process was they're just using me to win football games. That was my thought process. And I didn't realize that they actually was sharing real love until my brother got out of prison. And my dad then came back to my life because I was doing really good in football. And he wanted me to transfer to Ely High School, which was his high school.
Right.
And my brother.
Ely is a really good football program, don't they?
Yeah. Ely was a really good football program.
Yeah.
And my brother got out. My brother told my father that I was going to stay at Nova, that I wasn't going anywhere. Because my brother knew I had the support from the coaches and the staff and all that stuff. And so, it was just, I realized then that the coaches had my best interest.
Again, McLeod's older brother stepped in to guide him to make sure they did have his best interests at heart. And when McLeod got caught stealing, it was his coaches this time who stepped in to make sure that this didn't derail his future.
I was actually going to get expelled for stealing. The coach then had talked to me about playing sports. I didn't want to play sports. So they gave me an ultimatum. He said, listen, I can talk him down from expelling you, mm-hmm. but you got to get active. You got to do the right thing. And all I can hear is my brother in my head telling me, see, I told you, you got to get active. You got to do the right thing.
What do you think would have happened if your brother hadn't intervened and gotten into your life? And if you hadn't gotten into Nova, and these coaches hadn't given you the support that that they gave you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, that's scary to think about. I don't know what would have happened in my life. I could almost get emotional thinking about what would have happened. Yeah. I just wouldn't be here talking to you. I know that.
Yeah. Would you have gone down the same road as your brother, even though he was,
Yeah, I would have gone down the same road with my brother to prison. I feel like my uncle died of AIDS. I would have probably... alcoholic, drugs, I don't know. Yeah.
It's a whole different path, right?
Yeah, it's a whole different path. And that support you get from people help change the lives of thousands. You never know how far your support goes.
Right, because once they change your life, you've been now on a path to change other lives, right?
Yeah. Give it to... I talk to my high school head coach all the time, Willie Dodaro. He lives up in Georgia now. He's retired. And he called me his oldest son because I was the first one that went to college. He was the first year head coach when I started playing.
Oh, no kidding.
So we started out together. He sent probably about maybe hundreds of guys to college after that. Long story short, he calls me the oldest son. But I'm telling him, man, you don't know how many kids you affected through me by helping me because of what I do with mentoring and prison and what I've done through volunteer work was all because of what he did for me.
So you're passing that on, right? Paying that forward.
Right.
Yeah. Beautiful. That impact is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, big time. Yeah. Makes life worth living. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. Absolutely agree. It's the only way. Yeah. So now you're in high school. You're only playing football for 2 years, and then you get recruited by colleges. What was your feeling then? I mean, is that when you started to realize, hey, maybe these guys were right. I have a future in this.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I didn't know I had a future in it until I started getting recruited. And then I started realizing that's what my coach saw on me. He saw something special. And so that was a game changer for me when the college scouts told me that they think my talent is really good.
How'd that feel? Like validation on that.
Yeah, that felt good. It felt good. It felt real good. It felt like I had some sense of worth or purpose, which I never felt I had before. But it felt that good.
Even though the coaches had been telling you that, you still didn't believe them, right? Because you thought they just wanted you to win games. They could win games, but now you're seeing that they were telling you the truth.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I just really somehow in my heart of hearts thought maybe it was still to their benefit. But when I got on the plane to go to Louisville or Michigan and visit these colleges, I was like, this is really real.
And how did that change your attitude as a player and as a person?
Oh, it changed. I started living like in fear almost. Like, when I was growing up, you couldn't be afraid to die. You know what I mean? If you live by the gun, you got to die by the gun. Mm-hmm. All right. So, but at this moment, it's like, I'm afraid I'm going to die in my sleep. I'm going to miss out on this dream I'm having because life is really starting to turn around for me. Like, I can really leave Pompano, go somewhere, and see another part of this world, was my thought.
Yeah. And then you did that, right? You ended up going to Louisville.
Yeah, I went to Louisville, right.
And how was that? Was that like a whole shock for you, culture shock, or?
Yeah, it was. It was different. I mean, those guys, a lot of those guys got support. You got college kids. I mean, these are college kids. You know, it's 50,000 kids at the school, and they all look like they got money and support for their family.
Right.
And, you know, coming from this hole in the wall, and he's like, God dang, everybody's smiling and happy. You know, and so it was different for me. It was different.
How long did it take you to acclimate to that? Kind of get into the...
Well, it was fast. It was fast. What happened after my freshman year, the last game of the freshman year, I'll never forget. We had two guys. I'm 18 years old, man. I just finished my last game, bowl game in Liberty Bowl. And they just came back to school with two brand new cars, two seniors. And everybody's running out of the dorm. They're like, what happened? Well, we declared pro. I was like, oh. That easy, right? Like, I just played this game with you, like, I just played this football game with you, like, 3 weeks ago, right? We were in Memphis.
Yeah.
And you got a brand new car, and, you know, you're going pro, and I'm like, this is crazy. So, right then, I made up my mind. I was like, you know what? Only thing between me and the NFL is hard work. And so, at that moment, I told myself, the only way I go back to Pompano is in a body bag. I'm not going back. You know, there's no option to quit. And so, that was my mindset. Yeah.
That's a great mindset to have too, right? I mean, you had a goal now. Now you had something to look forward to, and now you actually had a purpose and a goal, and that's what you were going to work towards.
Right. Right.
So how was it for the rest of your college career after that?
That was a blur, man. It was just hard work. It was hard work, commitment, sacrifice, man. I didn't know what college was like. I didn't have a college party. I didn't know college fraternity. I just woke up every day working hard, man, making sure I'm eligible, studying my classwork. My teammates thought I was insane. I just wouldn't stop at the idea of I can make it to the NFL. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you did.
Yeah, I did, which was probably then the worst day of my life.
The worst? Wait. Tell me about that. So you get drafted, and it's the worst day of your life?
First day of my life, right, yeah. I get
that. Why is that?
There's some couple events lead up to that, but I get a call from the Baltimore Ravens on Sunday, and they say, we're going to draft you with our next pick, right? But I'm getting a call before that. I got a call from New Orleans Saints, say we're going to draft you with our next pick. They were right behind the Ravens.
Uh-huh.
But the Ravens call, I did not want to answer the phone because I'm a middle linebacker. And they had a guy named Ray Lewis already playing middle linebacker.
Never heard of Ray Lewis. Who is he?
Ray Lewis is
a no, I'm teasing you, brother. I mean, you know, God, come on. The guy's a legend. He's a Hall of Famer.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you just drafted middle linebacker, man. I just drafted two other linebackers, Creed Bolwear, James. And I'm saying to myself, this is the worst day of my life, fourth round. But it's my fault. I put myself in that position because, like I say, leading up to that combine and the workouts, when I was that guy that got the new car from the agent, and he put about $30,000 in my pocket that January, I went back to that kid that grew up in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I went to, you know, partying and thinking I made it and, you know, getting high. And so when it came time to actually work out for pro scouts and do what I need to do, I was number one rated inside linebacker coming into the draft. And I dropped from number one all the way to the fourth round as a draft pick because of that selfishness.
Really? So you went and partied and went back to your old ways, and that cost you four rounds.
Yep. Four years of hard work, effort, coming out. Number one rated inside linebacker rated in January. Lost my mind between those 2-3 months. And, yeah, lost a lot of stock.
Yeah. What'd you learn from that? What are you
I learned I needed help. I learned that a lot of the things that I dealt with as a kid, saw as a kid, went through as a young adult, I covered up with football. That mentally I needed to address those issues. And so that's really where I started living my life, understanding that I need to be honest about getting help.
And did you?
Yeah, I started on the journey. I thought it was gonna happen overnight. First thing I did was that, you know, so anybody give your life to Christ, you know, and magically God will make everything right. And I didn't realize that was a process. Then I decided, you know, I got married. I didn't know that was going to be a tough process. So didn't know how to treat a woman, treat a kid, and I bring all this in my life. I'm bringing stuff.
You had no experience in that whatsoever. You had no role models in terms of how to treat a woman, how to be a father, how to do any of these things.
No, I just thought if I got married, I'd do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
Marriage. So once you said I do, put the ring on, boom, everything's magic. Right, you know everything. You have all the
answers. That's what I thought. Yeah, I didn't say I do. I didn't know where I was going after that. But that was a process. So I just, went on this journey, man, trying to figure out, how can I defeat these demons that are inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And still working on that?
Yeah, still working on it. I realized it's a lifelong journey.
Correct.
I realized this, and that's what helped free me understand this lifelong journey. There's truth and grace and mercy and weakness all tied up. It's a big knot.
And that's the thing. That's the biggest part of it is that when you realize, there's no one day I'm going to wake up and be fixed or be perfect. And that this is part of the journey for me just to continue to be a better man, right?
Right.
On and on, learning, experiencing, taking in what I can from other men and just becoming better and better every day.
Mm. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what it is, right? It's I used to beat myself up back then. I beat myself up all the time, but I was beating myself up and I was missing out on inspiring others.
Mm.
I was missing out on encouraging people. I was missing out on the opportunities I was given to be a blessing, even though I was weak and wanted somebody to be a blessing to me, I was missing out on it. So as I got older, I stopped beating myself up and I realized, it's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. It's not worth it. And it's, and you're just going through what you're going through at that moment.
Right, at that moment, right.
And you take that in and you move forward from that piece.
Exactly.
And you take the next one and you move forward from that.
Exactly.
And there are no mistakes. Listen, everything that you experienced when you were growing up is who made you the man you are today, right?
Right. That's what it is.
You see that now, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The bad part of me actually created the good part of me, if you want to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Amen. I get that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was the contrast. You were able to see who you were before to become mm-hmm. who you are now.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So when you were on the Ravens, and listen, like Ray Lewis was very well known for being a great mentor and being a leader in that locker room. What was your experience around that with him and with a lot of the other men on the team? I mean, a lot of mentors there. You're getting into the league. You're a rookie. What was that like?
Yeah. Well, the NFL is it's a job, right? So you got these different cultures in the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
You got some that are husbands, some that are believers in faith. Some of that are just party animals, and you got some that are really serious about the game, and that's all I do is focus on the game. And so you got that, all those cultures mixed in one. Ray and I, we were together a lot because I was a backup. And so, you always got to hang with your backup, right? So, but we were young. I mean, and Ray was figuring it out. One thing Ray probably did for me was, I never forget, I used to get high a lot, and I won't. I guess I could say he probably made it too. We used to do it together. But long story short, he mentioned something one day. We were sitting in his living room. He said, "Listen, we got to stop." He said, "I feel so much better, man, when I don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I can breathe better. I can run better. But most importantly, man, my mom wants me to stop. My mom wants me to do right. She believes I could be great at this." And then he started talking about his future, that he could be this Hall of Fame guy. And, as a backup, I'm sitting there saying, yada, 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 right? I'm the backup. Right. I don't want to hear that noise anyway, right? I'm hoping you get hurt. So
you get hurt, you leave, or you get traded or something, right?
Right. So, but that was inspiring. That I think by the time we were probably 23 years old back then, and that he had that willpower to just stop, and really focus on being great at the game. And so a lot of that stuff, they come back to me until after I retired.
Yeah.
When I thought about a lot of conversations he and I used to have, and I used to always beat myself and say, man, I was around so much passion and so much desire, and I didn't want to draw from it at all.
Yeah.
At all. I completely disregarded it and shut it down.
Why do you think you did that? What was the reason for not paying attention to it for you?
Again, it goes back to that kid growing up selfish, angry, mad at the world because things just didn't go my way. You know, when I saw the kid that had the lunchbox or had support and the hug, you know, here I am talking to a guy that was drafted first round, that the coaches love him, they spoil him. So, you know, it goes back to just not wanting to support anything that I feel like anybody that got more support has. Yeah, you know, it's selfish, it's jealousy. Yeah. You know, why would I think that? I'm getting paid six figures, right? I got drafted. I'm on a team. Should be happy. But I'm just, you know, that's just the culture, man, that I grew up in.
Yeah. And again, you were able to take that experience and then turn that into fuel for the rest of your life, right?
Exactly. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I said it helped me see clearly that I need help. That you know, helped me see clearly too. And that's what helps me try to help others to see that as well.
You know what I'm feeling when you're saying that too, about you realize you needed help. How hard was it for you to ask for help? Because I got to figure with your upbringing and how, you know, you're in the streets and it's everybody for themselves and it's all about surviving. Was asking for help to you a sign of weakness?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, I thought that was just a man thing, but it was for me asking for help, because to ask for help, to me, you got to expose your weakness. Mm-hmm. And why are you asking for help? You know, and so I really want to help. I want to help. You know, I want to know what it's like to be faithful to my wife. I want to know what it's like not to have a drink to go to sleep. I want to know what it's like not to want to get high or mad or frustrated. And so I want to help in that area, in those areas. And so it was tough asking for that, but I had to understand that my life depended on it. And so if I want this long life of health and being effective and significant, then I got to show my weakness. I got to expose that.
And so you did?
Yeah, so I did. So I went through, I went through 12-step recovery programs. I went through marriage counseling. I've done all types of things, just hungry, trying to figure out how to overcome those things that were overtaking me.
Yeah, and that took a lot for you to go into these programs and do it, right?
Oh, yeah, it took a lot. Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting there. You know, I repeated that 30-day chip in that Celebrate Recovery class about six times. I couldn't go past 30 days without looking at porn or having a drink or something like that. And so, when I first stepped out to get help, I realized how bad it was for me. Because mm-hmm. when we cover up something, I thought I had control of it. I didn't realize how much control I didn't have until I was being challenged.
Yeah. How much control it had over you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah.
And then getting into it and seeing what was going on and actually taking ownership of all of this stuff is what was finally able, you know, is that where you were able to get past a lot of this move forward?
Yeah, I did. It took some years. I mean, this probably started about 2001. Mm-hmm. I think maybe around 2010. You know, it was about 6-7 years in a row where I feel like I quote unquote failed and cried and got up and failed and cried and got up and failed and cried and got up. And one that's been in my mind, you know, I'm not going to die not trying. So I just kept trying and fighting. And then one day I realized, Drew, it was funny, be the scenario, but I couldn't ride by liquor stores or like strip clubs. I couldn't go by certain things without feeling like an itch.
Yeah.
And this particular day, I was doing well. I hadn't done anything for about 25, 30 days. And I rode by this liquor store, and outside the liquor store were three women that I knew were dancing. The dance club was next door.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get that itch, that feeling or that. Yeah, and what's wrong with me? You know, like, I kept going. And so,
but I love that you said, what's wrong with me? Because you didn't feel that urge, right? You've been working towards this for years. Now you finally get it. You're like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, so then I have questioned myself. Like, what am I? You know? And so I get to the next light, and it hits me that I'm making progress. And then I was like, whoa, then something kind of kicked into me, because I always felt I didn't have a gift. That was part of my frustration after football, because I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. Because some people are good at, you know, writing or reading or hospitals or medical, cutting grass. I don't care what it is, right? So like me, I didn't have any. But I didn't. That next night, I realized I had a gift, and that was a competitive gift. because I saw myself being faithful up to like 2 months. And something in me said, you can do 3 months. And it's competitive nature keeping with me that was kind of fighting me.
Right.
And it came, same thing with drinking was the same way. And I realized that I had that gift that I was actually going to see myself defeat me. That became a fight.
Just you and you, right?
That's all there is.
Just you and you. That's it. Nobody else. Not about the alcohol. Not about other women. Not about strip clubs. Not about you and you.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it came down to. And Ray used to say it all the time. He said, you know, it's not about wins and losses. It's about the will between you and you. That's just what he say, you know.
Fantastic, man. Fantastic. So you did retire.
Yeah.
You got sober and everything. And then you started working with Men to Boys, right? So that, tell me how you got into that, because now that you see you have a gift for competition, you know it's you and you, you get past a lot of your own demons. When did you make the decision to get into what you're doing now?
Well, I had volunteered for Men to Boys probably starting in like 2009. I mean, the director would ask me to come in and speak, you know, as a former athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw what they were doing. And then eventually, about a year ago, he wanted to start talking about coming on as staff. Which I knew that role of volunteering speaking was going to expand to more being more engaging with the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened. I just want to do something more local. I was working for Prison Fellowship, which is more statewide.
Okay.
Programs in the prison.
Yeah.
But I wanted to start being more effective in Broward County. So that's why I decided to help out with Men to Boys.
Okay. Tell me about Men to Boys and what you guys do there. What's the purpose behind this organization?
So the mission behind it is mentoring. We mentor young youth, middle school through high school, ages like 12 to like 19.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of our youth come through the Department of Juvenile Justice. They're community service hours, diversion programs.
So they've already been picked up by the system.
Right, they've been picked up by the system. And so, you know, they got hours and they're on house arrest or something like that. And so the judge or that junior probation officer would advise them to, you know, if they felt like they need a mentor or a male figure, they would send them our way. And so it's a tough group to deal with, but it's so, you know, worth it. So our job, we hold groups 4 nights a week, 5:30 to 7:30. So I facilitate 2 of those groups 2 nights a week. And we also spend time with the boys individually on the weekends. So I do stuff like help train them for sports. We take them to, you know, Dave and Buster's. We take them out to, like, the library, Barnes & Noble's, things like that, robotics programs. We got a whole lot going on.
So it's just about spending time with these young men to get them back on the right track. Give them some positive male influence in their life.
That's exactly what it is, right, exactly.
So you find that a lot of the boys that are in these programs, they have no male role models, no men in their lives.
Yeah.
Prior to getting into the system.
Exactly. I see a lot of them that grew up like I did. It's like mentoring me all over again. No male role model, no support from mom or caregiver. And it's almost like, you know, you can't, it's like me when I said I was a kid, you know, how do you blame somebody for, you know, I didn't get a chance to ask God, let me go home with that family as well to do and get all the support.
Yeah.
You know, I'm put in a situation where, you know, there's no support, no resources. And then you want me to do right. So, yeah, but it's a lot of that going on.
Yeah. It's interesting. You just said so you're mentoring yourself. So, I mean, you know, if we look deeper at that, I mean, that's really what you went through to get here now. And we talked a minute ago about the impact the coach has had on you and now who you're having on these young men.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mentored myself because – It's easier that way because I see so much of me. And it's like, man, you thought it would be different because different generation, you get the millennials, from baby boomers, and all that stuff. But it's the same thing. It's the same exact thing with no support, no resources, and just you're in this. And so it's just, I'm passionate about encouraging them because I know, I ain't gonna say I know exactly what they want to hear, but I get it, right? Like
you've been there.
I've been there, right? Right, so it makes it a little easier, but it's also tough at the same time, you know, because you've got a couple guys, like for example, I got a guy that we mentor. All he do is fight. You know, these gangs try to get him to be a part of a gang. And I was like that, growing up in Cali City, Pompano. I fought every day when we had this whole gang thing established because they wanted, that's why I had to fight to get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. So this kid, you know, you sit here with mentor him, try to get him strategy, structure, understanding of, you know, the outcome and the consequences, what could happen if you go that route. But the minute you leave, you know, of course he's back to reality. 6 days, you know, 23 hours later, he's living in that reality where he gets an hour with us to try to help. And how much can you really do? Because he's fearing for his life. So, yeah. You know, that's a tough situation.
You ever feel like you're fighting a losing battle or, you know, pushing a rock uphill over and over and over again with some of these kids?
Oh, yeah. All the time. I just, you know, you win some and you lose some. We had five guys get in the car accident the other day. They left group, you know, no doubt speeding. Somebody lost their life. We talked to these guys about being reckless and driving and all this stuff about the dangers of smoking marijuana. And then all of a sudden you wake up, you get a call at 1 a.m. Broward General, you know, two of them bleeding from the brain. But then you also get a call from a guy that we've been mentoring who lives in his brother got shot, dad's in prison. He had no hope. And now he's working at Walmart. He's a senior. He's going to graduate high school. He wants to go to college. So you get these stories up and down, you know. That's what gives me strength. Well, you know, when you want to think about stepping away, think about those guys.
Yeah, I was going to just ask you that. What makes you stay in it? What's the passion that drives you to continue doing this every day?
Yeah, it's the ones that you see that get it and that want to, that believes that they could change, that they could change the situation. That's what gives me strength.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so yeah. I'm feeling that, yeah, it's the ones who really want to make that change.
Yeah.
And appreciate right. what you're doing for them, that take the mentoring, take the advice, and move themselves forward.
Right. And it's only one out of a few. I mean, yeah, I'll be honest with you. You know, you're talking maybe one out of 10. Mm-hmm. You know, the other nine are sitting there looking at you like, yeah, whatever. Right. And so, but it's that one. And so, but that's what it is. So I was always told, the whole saying is, you know, treat one like you want to treat everyone, or do for one like you wish you could do it for everyone.
Yeah.
So that's what it's all about.
Sure, the numbers don't matter. It's who you
right.
reach.
It's who you reach, right.
I mean, look at you. You were the one that your coaches reached, and look what you're doing.
Exactly.
So this one kid that you have that's working at Walmart and wants to go to college, what's he going to do? What's that ripple effect going to be?
Oh, man, that can affect a lot. Yeah.
Right? So that's the one you got to focus on right
that's
there.
That's the one you focus on.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing. You know, listen, I want to ask you about something else too, because you mentioned this to me when we talked earlier about in the prison fellowship, right? So you tell me a little bit about the prison fellowship, and then I'm going to ask you about the angel tree.
Okay. Well, I work with prison fellowship also as a field director. And so my job there is I recruit and train volunteers. I establish programs in prison. And recruit angel tree churches for the, you know, those children of inmates.
Right. So tell me about that. So that's kids whose parents, you know, one parent, both parents are in prison.
Mm.
And you guys have this angel tree program. And this is what you get donations to buy gifts for the kids of inmates. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Right. Well, what we do is we have the parents that are incarcerated, men and women, sign their kids up to an application throughout May and August of the summer months. And we get those applications back. They're all national. It's throughout the whole country. And we vet them by each state and down by zip code. And so I'm responsible from as far as like Tampa down to Homestead to recruit Angel Tree churches. So we go out to churches and organizations to buy these kids a Christmas gift on behalf of their parents. And so that's really what it boils down to, buying a Christmas gift on behalf of the parents.
Tell me how that is. I mean, that sounds amazing, and the impact has got to be incredible.
Yeah, it, you know, when I say, hey, buy a Christmas gift, it can sound like a little thing, but when you get together at these events, these churches that, you know, we talk to and say, hey, I got 50 kids in your community that lives within a 5-mile radius who got a parent in prison. We can bring them here on December 15th at 3:00. We can give them their gifts. And when you bring those kids in, that sometimes is the only gift they get, one.
Yeah.
Two is, it's an emotional for them because their mom or dad is incarcerated and actually went through the length of this to get them a gift. And then the caregiver, sometimes grandma, aunt, whoever the kids live with, really appreciates it because it just shows them that their parents, somebody cares about them. And so it's a phenomenal thing. And I also host industry camps with the kids as well, sports camps. So we try to engage those kids as much as possible to not, one, family reconciliation, but also not allow them to follow the same path as their parents.
Right, get them involved in activities, get them doing something, giving them that support and that mentoring that they need too.
Exactly.
So, I'm feeling the impact that it makes, not only on the kids, but what about on the parent that's incarcerated?
Well, it makes a big difference for them too, because most of the parents, again, at least the ones I've come across, there's thousands of them, were raised with, no support, no this, no that. You know, a lot of them just made a bad decision, right? But it does wonders for them because it shows their child that they're thinking about them, because the child, when they come visit them or writes them, they're always talking about the gift. And so when I go back to like the prison, I like interview or do a program, somebody always run me down, say, hey man, thanks for sending my child that gift, man. That means so much, man. They just love it. They this, they that. And it brings such a joy to them. And it creates a better community in prison. You know, so the stabbings, the fights, all that stuff, just by having something that builds morale and that, really helps out.
Sure, and showing that people care, right? There are people out there that really do give a shit, right?
Yeah, exactly, right. Because a lot of them can't sign that kid up if they're getting in fights. It's a privilege inside the prison system.
Right.
So you'd be amazed at how many avoid fights or violence or anything because they want to sign the child to get a Christmas gift.
Fantastic, man. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Just beautiful. Now, were you an Angel Tree recipient when your dad was in prison or no? Okay, so you hadn't experienced this. This was...
No, I hadn't experienced this at all.
So this wasn't like, something that you had gotten involved in because you had the same experience. Okay.
Right, yeah.
Got it.
I wish I would have. It would be my only gift.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So there were Christmases where you got nothing.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of Christmases.
So how does it feel being on this end now, being able to bring this to these kids?
Oh, man, it's a joy that's indescribable. I mean, to see the, I see the look that I would have had on my face. Mm-hmm. It's like me raising my sons. I see the look of what it looks like to have a dad, And so I enjoy that more than if I would have had it, to be honest with you. I like living on this side.
Yeah. The giving side.
Yeah, the giving side, right.
Sure.
Yeah. I love on this side,
A lot of impact on the giving side, isn't there? Right,
big time, man.
The heart, giving love, and everything else.
Right. Exactly.
So, tell me about your kids. I mean, and how your childhood has affected how your race, and then also the mentorship that you've got with these other organizations that you work with, and seeing these other kids. How has that affected how you're raising your own children?
It made me more personable. My kids, I really find time to talk to them. And I mean, they're older now. It's 20 and 17. 17 is a senior in high school. But when they were younger, I was really intentional on being the face, being that guy. And so, if we took a trip to Tallahassee, we take the longest route just so we can talk. We got 27 all the way down. We look
just at spend cows, some time together, right?
Cow pastures, yeah, right. So we spend time together. So it really helped me engage, and they're like my best friends outside of being my sons. It affected me in a lot of ways too, because I still, when I was younger, I struggled with being affectionate with my kids because I didn't know what affection was like. I mean, I didn't tell my oldest son I love you till he was about 10. And I didn't know how to formulate those words. And so I still struggle with that even to this day, because again, that was in my DNA. My makeup was, you gotta be tough. You don't show weakness and all that stuff. And so that's part of my needing help is being affectionate to them, learning how to hug on them and give them a father's kiss and all that stuff. But I'm still growing in that area, but I made sure I was intentional with teaching and giving them who I was and who I am. So they know all about my past and what I've been through. And I always told them I would share my weakness and not my strengths, because my weakness is what made me who I am.
Amen. Tell me more about that, because that you know, listen, we talk about, for us, we have the Sacred Seven core values, and I sent you a copy of them, and that mm-hmm. first one that we have is courage, right? Courage is the foundation of all of them, and then after that comes honesty. Mm. So what you're saying is, you know, sharing your fears, sharing your failures with your sons, that takes a tremendous amount of courage to be that honest. So tell me what that was like when you had these conversations with them.
Yeah, it was more like, you know, I'm not sure how they're going to receive it. Like when they were older, like my oldest son was, I think he was about 13, 14. You know, we got in a conversation about sex and all that stuff. And just talking about where I felt as a kid and how I was, even getting married to their mom, how I wasn't ready, but I used that as an opportunity to just get married, to build a team around me, a selfishness. And so my kids, to be honest with you, they receive it. They received it as a sign of strength from me by telling them my weakness, but I had alcohol weakness, my weakness with, you know, sex and all that, my weakness, and just being like, feel like I'm not smart enough.
Right.
I feel like I'm intimidated of educated people. I used to tell them about that. And so but I wanted them to know who I was. And I think what happened with me, my son was about 11 and he was at a middle school thing. And they asked these kids who they wanted to be like growing up. And everybody said everything else, but my son said he wanted to be like his father. And so it hit me. Everybody was like, look at me, smile. I'm smiling back. But I'm also saying, my son don't even know me. Like, at that time, I was kind of still hiding, struggling with things.
You were still hiding and struggling, you said?
Yeah, because I would like hide when I drink, or I was hiding. My thoughts towards like pornography. I was hiding those types of things. Not that he would even know all that, but it was bothering because I was struggling so much mentally and dealing with alcohol that I was like, he wants to be like me, but he doesn't know who I really am.
Yeah.
And so I made it a point when he was about 13. So I carried that for a while to tell him my struggles.
Yeah.
And so I shared that with him vividly, and it helped him too, because it really gave him an understanding of what he was struggling with. And we didn't talk about, you know, everybody deals with something, right? Even middle school struggle with sex, right?
But sure.
He just, so it helped him also. Yeah.
Yeah. So how'd that feel when you finally came, told him the truth, you were honest with him and open, vulnerable, all of that?
Yeah, it felt like a relief. It did feel like a relief. I think I told him, I said, now somebody knows who I am at my funeral. You know, I told him that because, you know, I felt like I was going to be a hypocrite at my funeral, you know. And so I shared with him, you know, and so it felt like weight was lifted on me. I even shared with times I was unfaithful to his mom because, sometimes she'd get upset. She could act out with that and they would hear it or something.
Yeah.
And so, but he told me, he said, Pop, you know, if I can forgive you, I'm sure she can too, you know. Mm-hmm. And but it helped me understand that, you know, this is who I am, and he still looks up to me.
Yeah, of course, because now, I mean, there's even more to look up to now, right, Tyrus? I mean, here's a guy who's coming, had the courage to be honest with him. Now you're living in integrity because you're the same guy outwardly as you are inwardly, and you're, you know, you're not hiding anything anymore.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So, you know, what's not to love and respect more about that?
Exactly, right.
You know, and I think for me, I know we find that kids are way more intuitive than we give them credit for.
Oh, yeah.
Right? More. So you're, you know, here we are. We could think, oh, I'm hiding this. He doesn't know about all my shit. But we do. And then it becomes worse because they don't see that honesty and integrity in their father.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. It becomes worse. Yeah. And that was my one of my fears, is that if I don't man up and share with them who I really am, one, I feel it's going to affect them as men when they grow up, because I think they're going to struggle with similar issues. If it's not that, it's something, right?
Yeah.
And so to hear about me fighting is going to help them fight. And two, if they find out down the road that I was a hypocrite or a liar, it's going to bring some tension between us.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's going to know it, right? And it's just going to make things worse. So
make it worse, right.
You know, I want to ask you, now, do your kids know, I mean, obviously they know about your past. I mean, how much contact do they have with your family and the relatives?
Well, my mom, they talk to all the time.
Okay.
And my mom. But my siblings, they probably see maybe like 3-4 times a year at holidays. But they know of them. I mean, they see where they live. Mm-hmm. And my sister's still on drugs. I mean, my brother lives in, you know, and they see the environment. They always, you know, they question me, you know, why are you so different? You know, and mm-hmm. escape from the passion of wanting to be different. So they speak to them.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, what the positive aspect of that is they, you know, again, it's a more complete picture of their dad. And you were able to work your way out of.
Right. That. Right. They see that. Right.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Cause there's, you know, it's a thing that you said, and I want to hear when you said, what hurts me the most is when you go back to your old community and see your friends walking around, their pants hanging down, selling drugs. They look at you and say, you think you're better than us.
Mm.
So tell me about that feeling about, you know, having to go back and get that. Because, I mean, listen, we all go through that. As we grow right. in our lives and become who we are meant to be, mm-hmm. there are always going to be those others who didn't live up to their potential, and they're going to try and drag you down.
Yeah.
So how has that experience been for you?
Yeah, it's been a tough experience because I got a lot of love for the kids that grew up in a similar neighborhood, my neighborhood that I grew up in. And when I go back, you know, you figure that, you know, these guys wouldn't treat you any different. It actually, it kind of hurts when you see guys that you grew up with that turn their back on you when you come on the park, that walk the other way, that try not to look at you. And I know what it is. A lot of it's embarrassment from their part because they didn't, you know, they decided to take that route.
Mm-hmm.
So I shouldn't be embarrassed about what I've tried to do. But it does bother me in a way because, you know, I'm there in love and not to show anything else that I think I'm better than anybody else.
Right.
So,
you're there for the support, to be there for them, to show right. that, you know, you can make it, be an example, those kind of things.
Right. Even try to be an example to the kids where you are. I mean, you don't have to have it all together, you know, but you still can be an example to the youth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so that, you know, that's where it's at.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. I'm also feeling a little bit of it. Like, you know, when you were younger and you were angry, when you'd see these kids that had what you didn't have, right? You had that jealousy and anger. So now you can feel that part of them that's looking at you coming back, that jealousy and anger that they have, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. I see it from both ends. Right, and it hurts, yeah.
Yeah, hurts? Tell me how it hurts.
Well, because the thing is, my heart is different. You know, it's my thought is different. My mindset is different. You know, I'm not that angry guy. I'm not that jealous guy, you know what I mean? So, like, my grandfather would often say, you know, I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you what you're doing is not working. You know what I mean? Like, so it's more one of those things of, You know, you can't give up hope on that you're not worth anything because you could be worth something to these young men out here. And so that's what I try to get across to guys from my generation that feel some kind of way about me. But I don't know if that would ever happen.
Yeah, that is some fantastic advice from your grandfather right there.
Yeah, he wasn't the smartest guy, but he had a little wisdom.
Yeah, you know, I gotta say, yeah, that's a great way to put it, man. The wisdom is everything, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's everything. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And you know, I'm gonna end on this with you because, you know, you were talking about just being angry, and not having that in your heart anymore. And you had said before that you can be angry all you want, but at the end of your life, people will just remember you as an angry man, or you can leave a legacy. And so for you, Tyrus, what's the legacy that you want to leave after you're gone?
Yeah, that quote, my legacy is, you know, I've always you know, there's you know, we can look at this world, or we can look at life, and we can say, you know, it's good, it's bad, it's evil and good, however you want to determine it. Mm-hmm. My legacy, I just want to be a part of something that was good. I want to be a part of something that kept good moving. I got a short window of life. I think we all do, at, you know, 80 years at best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here I am winding down, probably about a good 20 left. And so I'm thinking to myself, and what can I do to affect the small window of time that I got left? And so the legacy I love to leave is, how do I push goodness into the next generation? How do I do what I can to sow seeds to push that, to keep that going during my little short window of time of life? So that's really all I live for, is how can I move that window in my part?
Right. Get as many of those young men out of the situation that you were in and into the situation that you're in now.
Exactly. Right. And hopefully they do the same thing going forward.
Yeah, that's the ripple effect he's talking about. His impact is making ripples in that community and leaving a legacy where these men keep passing that mentorship and guidance on down through the generations. And I can feel those ripples spreading out wider and wider, changing lives the way McLeod's was changed, just by having a few good, strong men guide him and set him on the right path, believing in his talents and believing in his greatness. Now, this is something we don't celebrate enough, the power of men helping and guiding other men. And I applaud McLeod for his dedication and his devotion to pass that on. It comes from courage, and it comes from commitment, and from duty, and from love. And that is truly heroic. So now I want to know what you got out of Tyrus McLeod's story. As always, you can let me know. Social links are on our website, WLKHpodcast.com. Click on them, leave me a comment. Let me know what you think about this week's episode. And also, you can join the Warriors, Lovers, Kings, and Heroes group on Facebook. Always, like I always ask you, make sure to share this show with men you know are going to get some value out of it. All right, so please pass that on. And I want to thank Tyrus McLeod for joining us today, for being real and raw and honest and telling us the story of his journey to modern manhood. And I want to thank you for listening to Eric Rogel Talks with Warriors, Lovers, Kings, and Heroes today. I'm Eric Rogel, and I'm honored to be with you, to be your brother by your side on your hero's journey. I'll talk to you next week.
That's what ransomware is all about. It's psychological pressure.
Ransomware, when your computer's hacked into and your data held ransom. Attacks are on the rise, and Russian gangs are making billions of dollars.
The moment I got that message, I knew our greatest fears that we ever have are starting to come true.
The post-Cold War era is over.
.com, The Hacking. A new season from Crowd Network with me, Katie Puckrick. Just search for .com, that's D-O-T-C-O-M, and subscribe.